The shoes keep dropping at the Phoenix VA. The center's director and two others are now on administrative leave, and another whistleblower has come forward. Are soldiers in harm's way at home?
We send them downrange, and we put them in harm's way, and nobody's worried about the budget then. Now when we come home, we're worried about how much it's going to cost.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the Phoenix VA and the system overall. Also, the feds are investigating how ASU and dozens of other universities are handling reports of sexual assault.
Arizona submits its application for a waiver from No Child Left Behind.
And a West Valley city, not that one, looks for development around a sports venue.
We're not building new out of a cotton field. We're taking real successful area, and we're looking to add it to the next level.
Plus art, picked by museum goers and giving some critics heartburn.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. No problems to tell you about in Valley traffic at this point. However, we do have a nice day on the way for the rest of the afternoon. Sunny skies with a high of 94 degrees. Warming up over the weekend, we could see 100 degrees either Saturday or Sunday. Right now, mostly sunny skies, 91 degrees.
A federal appeals court panel has scheduled a June 17th hearing in Seattle to consider former Arizona Congressman Rick Renzi's appeals of his convictions on public corruption and money laundering charges. A federal jury in Tucson convicted Renzi last June, and a judge in December sentenced him to 3 years in prison. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is allowing Renzi to remain free pending the outcome of his appeal. Renzi represented Arizona's 1st congressional district from 2003 to 2009. He did not run for re-election in 2008 while facing federal charges accusing him of looting a family insurance business to help pay for his 2002 campaign.
Some Phoenix students tested their ability to text and drive today. Allstate's Traveling Reality Rides tour stopped in the Valley to try to reach kids during prom season. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, people 20 and younger make up the largest population of distracted drivers. Allstate agent Misty Everett was at Arcadia High and explains how the Jeep simulator works.
Somebody from outside the car is texting them. They can talk on the phone, the radio's playing, and inevitably they run off the road, hit a pedestrian, or hit another car. So it's a safe environment for them to see how dangerous their possibly typical behaviors are.
Arizona doesn't have a texting while driving ban. A bill that would prohibit phones for new drivers died while working its way through the legislature. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Three administrators with the Phoenix VA, including its director, Sharon Hellman, are on administrative leave. The U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki, took that action yesterday. And a second whistleblower has come forward, alleging problems with patient care and attempts to cover it up. Dr. Samuel Foote was the first whistleblower to come forward.
I had patients coming in saying I've been waiting 3, 6, 9, 12 months for an appointment at the time when the administration was bragging about how they've got the waiting times down. You know, half the people are being seen in 2 weeks. And the numbers just didn't add up.
Among Foote's allegations is that the VA kept a secret waiting list. But speaking Tuesday on CNN, Hellman and her chief of staff, Dr. Darren Deering, denied any efforts to hide wait times.
We have never instructed our staff to create a secret list, to maintain a secret list, to shred a secret list. That has never come from our office as far as instruction to our staff.
It's never come from me.
In a statement, Hellman says she respects the secretary's decision to put her on administrative leave. Foote, though, doesn't buy the hospital administration's explanations.
Every time the administration answers that question, they say, we did our own review and we did not find anyone who died from a preventable cause. All right, not the same question. All right, 40 people died while waiting for care.
As a veteran himself, former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Richard Carmona has experience with the VA. He says the Phoenix allegations are disturbing.
I was concerned that if it was true, that it's a terrible thing. But if it's just an allegation, I'm concerned because it undermines the confidence in the Veterans Administration if things like this happen, even if it weren't true. Because right now, all of our attention should be focused on providing timely, efficient, effective care to the hundreds of thousands of veterans we have, not only from Iraq and Afghanistan, but from the previous wars, who desperately need the VA to provide them essential services.
Is there a concern on your part this could be a systemic problem? Is there a concern it could be getting worse, that as we're having more soldiers, we're actually not doing as good a job caring for them?
There's a great deal of stress on the Veterans Administration now. to provide care for hundreds of thousands that are injured, who the silent wounds of war, the mental health problems, PTSD, and so on. And yet, part of this responsibility at least falls on Congress because, 11 years ago when we started two wars, nobody told the Veterans Administration to ramp up. In fact, they heard a different story, that this would all be over in a few days. So the VA is trying to play catch up right now with an infrastructure that can't possibly absorb the tremendous amount of disease and disease burden in the returning population. So that being said, we all have to pull together here. The goal here is we need to make sure that these young men and women who have sacrificed so much have access to timely care. And if the VA or the Department of Defense can't do it, then it's our obligation to contract with private services to ensure that they get the care they need.
As a former Surgeon General and in your other roles, you dealt extensively with the federal government. You mentioned Congress. How difficult is it to make these changes when we're talking about such a big system, as I said, a system that's going to have even more responsibility in the years to come?
Unfortunately, all of these things become politicized within the Beltway. Yet, I see the issue of the needs of our veterans as being something that's not Republican or Democrat. This is something that should be purely American. It's reprehensible that young men and women have to wait sometimes 6 to 9 months to get into the system, that they have problems that go unchecked, that we have a suicide a day in our nation, higher than that the casualties we get at war. And so this is really going to take Congress to act together in a nonpartisan or bipartisan way and provide the resources necessary to ensure that every single one of our young men and women who have served selflessly in defense of our nation get all of the care they need. We send them downrange and we put them in harm's way, and nobody's worried about the budget then. Now when we come home, we're worried about how much it's going to cost. The cost of war is going to be borne over the next half a century, as we've learned in the Second World War in Vietnam. This is going to be very costly for us because these 20 and 30-year-old kids are going to need some type of support, often for the rest of their lives and their families as well. And that's an obligation we incur when these young men and women are put in harm's way to benefit our nation.
Finally, do you believe that these alleged problems will be solved?
These are unusual circumstances now. If it is true, then I know General Shinseki will move quickly to correct the problem because it's a departure from the policies that have been set in place, the values that the VA has. I'm concerned because the mere discussion of something like this, even if the allegations prove to be untrue, undermines the confidence in the VA. These type of allegations need to be investigated, as you point out, and we need to deal with them swiftly.
Former Surgeon General Dr. Richard Carmona.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. We begin with a statistic that no one would put on their college transcript.
We know the numbers. 1 in 5 of every one of those young women who's dropped off that first day of school, before they finish school, will be assaulted in her college years.
Vice President Joe Biden speaking about a White House effort to combat sexual assault on college campuses across the country. In addition to the 1 in 5 stat for women, 6% of men reportedly experience some sort of sexual assault, and 70% of gay and transgender students report sexual harassment of some kind. ASU is one of 55 colleges and universities the Federal Education Department is investigating over how they're handling reports of sexual assault. But the U.S. Education Department says just because a school is on the list and subject to an investigation does not mean it has violated the law. In a statement, ASU says, quote, "It takes all Title IX sexual misconduct complaints very seriously, thoroughly investigates them, and if violations are found, delivers swift and appropriate punishment. The underlying matter leading to the university's appearance on this list was handled consistent with these standards."
But ASU grad Jasmine Lester says she's not surprised the university is on the Education Department's list. She filed a complaint against a professor, but ASU officials said there was not enough evidence to act. Lester founded Sun Devils Against Sexual Assault to help victims because she knew she wasn't alone.
This kind of stuff is going on at pretty much every school, in that I should connect ASU to the movement because I knew there were students at ASU going through similar things that I went through. So when I created Sun Devils Against Sexual Assault, I started getting emails and messages from other victims thanking me for creating the resource and for coming forward and showing them that they could come forward too if they wanted to. I really try and be supportive of students going through this because I know firsthand the administration is not going to be supportive. And then another important aspect is trying to bring these violations to the surface so that ASU has to deal with them so that more students won't have to.
Is there a federal role here? Vice President Biden seems to think so, and so do lawmakers who want to make the atmosphere on college campuses more transparent for parents and students. Joining us now, Congresswoman Jackie Speier from California's 14th District. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Great to be with you, John.
So I'm a dad with three college-bound daughters and two college-bound sons. How do you protect people with a federal initiative?
Well, to make it even more personal, I have a sophomore in college who's a young co-ed. So there are a number of things we can do. One is require annual climate surveys. We've done that in the military. It creates automatic accountability. The legislation that I'm going to be introduced, known as the HALT Act, will also require disclosure, public disclosure of all resolution agreements. Those are the agreements that the Department of Education makes with the university after there's been a complaint relative to Title IX, and most of these complaints are filed under Title IX. More money for investigators, Title IX investigators. The legislation is also going to provide for posting signage in public places of what the rights are for individuals who are raped, what their opportunities are for filing complaints, and where they can get help. Beyond that, we also need training. We need training of local law enforcement, training of the first responders, the healthcare providers, so that these victims have a shot at getting the kinds of resolutions they should have.
Congresswoman, I wonder if you'd share some of the background here in that, you know, obviously you're aware of what goes on and you're a mother of a college student. But it seems as though some of this initiative came out of the fight in Congress over getting the military to be more accountable about sexual assault and the military using the argument that, hey, we're doing as well as college campuses. Can you share that a little bit?
Actually, that's precisely true. I've been working on sexual assault and rape in the military now for 3 years, and oftentimes the brass from the Pentagon would come to me and say, well, hey, look, our numbers are better than college campuses, as if that was a basis on which to somehow herald the disaster that exists in the military as it relates to this issue. And as I looked at the issue, I realized they are parallels. You have closed systems in both cases. You have internal law enforcement. You have in the military a uniform code of military justice. On college campuses, you have a code of moral conduct. And as a result, the administrations in both institutions have swept these cases under the rug. And the parallels are really stunning and at the same time chilling.
But is there a national, it's not really a parallel in the sense that we tolerate binge drinking. We love to go to movies about people being kind of crazy on college campuses. This goes way back to toga parties and that sort of thing. And if we were to look at the U.S. News and World Report college rankings and maybe see signs of a school being a party school, is it possible that that's actually capturing some of the tolerance you're talking about without really showing the statistics that parents and students maybe should know more about?
Well, in fact, I have authored a letter that's a bipartisan letter in the House that was signed by more than 13 members to U.S. News and World Report, asking them to include as one of the issues in their ranking the status of whether or not there's an appropriate level of oversight on college campuses. Do they handle sexual assault cases promptly? Interestingly enough, the top four ranked universities on the U.S. News and World Report ranking, all four of them are either in the process of responding to Title IX complaints that have been filed or have just recently resolved Title IX complaints. And Title IX is the umbrella law that provides that in education, everyone should be free from discrimination.
And as we noted, the statistics also involve men and gays on campus. You know, Vice President Biden said right here at the top of the hour, we know the numbers. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Vice President Biden, but I didn't know those numbers. I don't think we know the numbers. Do you think we know the numbers?
No, I don't think we know that. When 20% of the college co-eds are going to have an experience with either attempted sexual assault or sexual assault at some point during their college career, that is a frightening number. And it's the first question whenever you go on a college tour, it's the first question that is asked by parents. And I heard it every school that we went to. What are you doing about sexual assaults on campus? And they would always say, well, we have blue phones, we have this. You know, the truth is, I don't think any of us knew how widespread it really is.
You know, we talked with Sophie Karasek at the top of the hour, and she had an experience at UC Berkeley. We don't want to make this about UC Berkeley because, as she said very responsibly, this is a national problem. Can you assure us this is indeed a national problem?
Oh, absolutely. It's a national problem. I met with Sophie. I met with Chancellor Dirks. And I want, and I said this to the chancellor, I want UC Berkeley to become the model for the rest of the country as to how you handle sexual assault on campus. And there has to be zero tolerance. One of the young co-eds I talked to at UC literally was not only after she filed the complaint and had a stay-away order, the assailant violated it. The second year, she was put in the same dorm with this assailant on the same dorm floor. So that shows a true lack of recognition of how pervasive and how serious the problem is and how most universities have basically not responded appropriately.
Representative Jackie Speier, Democratic Congresswoman representing California's 14th Congressional District. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's The Takeaways. John Hockenberry.
Coming up, when most people remodel their kitchen or bathroom, they take a sledgehammer to everything they're getting rid of and toss it in a dumpster. But what if there were another way?
Last year, we distributed over $2.8 million worth of usable material back into the community that might otherwise just have gone to the landfill.
A local nonprofit is trying to keep building supplies from going to waste. That's ahead on the show.
The State Education Department yesterday sent off its formal application to its federal counterpart for a waiver from the No Child Left Behind Act. That comes about a week after Washington State became the first state in the country to lose its waiver. There are two issues on which the state and feds disagree: the weight given to graduation rates in Arizona's high school rankings and how the state uses the AIMS test in its teacher evaluations. Carla Phillips has been working on Arizona's waiver. She's the director of cross-divisional leadership initiatives for the State Department of Education.
The approval that we received for this current school year was conditional, and Arizona was placed on high-risk status. So technically, we still have to address the outstanding conditions for this current year, get those taken care of for our application for next year to be discussed.
Where do we stand with that?
So the state board approved last year an increase in the graduation rate for letter grades for high schools, basically went from about 1.5% of the total points to 15%. The issue left to be decided is how a new scale should look, because it remade points. So that's the issue before the board in May, is to finalize what we call the letter grade scale with that increased graduation rate. And the second issue is a little bit more complicated and where some of the other states have had issues as well. It really has to do with the role of the state assessment in the determination of growth for educator evaluation systems.
How is that complicated by the fact that Arizona is going to be changing its standardized test?
Well, it's even more complicated because we are not the only state that's going to be doing that. The federal guidance requires that the state assessment play a significant part in the determination of growth. So we had already gone back to the board last year and required a certain amount of growth. The proposal that we are going to advocate for is that we will be more prescriptive regarding that, but in 2016, after the new assessment comes in play.
Is there any sense from folks in Washington that what Arizona is proposing is something that, that the federal Department of Education will be okay with?
That's a hard question to answer. I think, in all fairness, they have tried to be flexible. But on the other side, they've issued certain guidance that they need to be adhering to. And remember, we're 2.5 years into this, and every go-around has gone deeper into details and policy.
What happens if we don't get the waiver?
Well, it's interesting because, as you know, Washington went through that last week, and I've had conversations with them before and since. And we're watching to see what happens with them. And the schools, probably the biggest part, is the schools lose a lot of flexibility over how to use their Title I dollars.
Is there more of a sense of urgency because of Washington losing its waiver, or does what happened there not really influence what happens here?
I wouldn't say it's going to influence how our what our approach has been. We're just watching it to see how their negotiations went. But they were in a different place, even though the issue was pretty much the exact same, the role of the state assessment and teacher evaluations. Their job was they had to get a legislative amendment, and their legislature failed that bill. So they, after that, there's not that much the department or their commissioner could do. For us, it's really about the state board and working with them. And so we're in a different, the solution looks different, or potential solution looks different here.
Carla Phillips is the Director of Cross-Divisional Leadership Initiatives for the State Department of Education. The U.S. Education Department says it's received Arizona's waiver and is reviewing it and hopes to have a decision on it by the end of the current school year.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. The show is a KJZZ original production blending news from our community with national and international stories. Nothing going on in Valley traffic yet, although the afternoon commute not far away. As far as weather's concerned, we'll stay sunny and warm this afternoon. Look for a high temperature near 94. And then this weekend, boy, if you have a pool, might be a good weekend to try it. We might get up to 100 degrees for a high. Currently, relative humidity is at 6%, sunny skies and 91 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Live Nation, presenting Steely Dan, Jamalot Ever After Tour on July 15th at Comerica Theater. Tickets available now at Ticketmaster.com.
By one government estimate, 160 million tons of construction and demolition waste end up in landfills every year. One Valley nonprofit is trying to keep some of it out of the trash. In the second part of the Rubbish Project, KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports.
It's just after 7 in the morning, and a team from Stardust Building Supplies is hard at work.
We are in a house that is up in the North Scottsdale area, and looks to me like they're doing a complete remodel.
Karen Jane is executive director of Stardust. Its crew is doing what's called a deconstruction. Instead of just taking a sledgehammer to everything the homeowner wants to get rid of, Stardust carefully removes the material.
I believe we're taking the kitchen and a couple of bathrooms, chandeliers, light fixtures. And some built-ins, like a built-in bar.
It's cool because it's all one big piece and it's got a sink in it. That's what I like about it.
Jason Carlisle is a Stardust deconstruction supervisor.
I run a crew and we do about, on the average, 2 homes a day. Kitchens, bathrooms, doors, windows, appliances. We get some odd stuff sometimes. We've taken elevators out of people's homes. We've taken statues and flagpoles. The main goal is just to kind of change the whole idea behind remodel. Instead of the old-fashioned get a dumpster out front and throw stuff away, there is somebody out there that's willing to go through and kind of see if there's a reuse for it.
In the kitchen, Jason's crew is removing all the cabinets. They're in great shape, even if they're painted a shade of sea green we'll call interesting. Workers remove the doors, unscrew the cabinets from the wall, and carry them out to a truck. Those cabinets and the rest of the unwanted material in this house are headed to one of Stardust's 3 stores where they're sold at a discount. Karen Jane says the proceeds benefit 2 programs that help nonprofit agencies and low-income homeowners.
Last year, we distributed over $2.8 million worth of usable material back into the community that might otherwise just have gone to the landfill.
A lot of material, says Jason Carlisle.
We save an average of 650 tons a year from going to our landfills.
According to the EPA, construction and demolition debris accounts for a quarter of non-industrial waste in the U.S. each year. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the second story in KJZZ's Rubbish Project. Our series on trash continues next week on Morning Edition.
There are multiple approaches to waste diversion. One of the Valley's biggest corporations, Intel, has a corporate goal of recycling 90% of its solid waste. Tamur Berkey, Intel's solid waste program manager, describes the biggest challenge a company can face.
The key thing a lot of the time is understanding what is the infrastructure of the neighborhoods we're in. What are the companies out there that can manage, help us manage our waste? For example, cardboard is easily recyclable, right? I can segregate it, I can send it off, and there are people that will take it and recycle it into more cardboard. The bigger question is, do I have vendors for them? And then it becomes more interesting when you start looking at some of the waste streams that are harder to recycle. Food waste. I produce it, cafes produce it, hospitals, schools, etc. What do we do with it? Some places, they take it and they mix it at the POTW, the publicly owned treatment works, and from there they have like an enclosed system from which you get compost and then you generate methane using a biodigester and you can sell both. Other places take it and compost it. Other places take it, dry it out, and burn it for energy. Other places throw it in landfills, right? It's just a question of trying to understand, well, how much do I have? Can I segregate it? What can go where? And is there someone that will help me out? Can I actually pay someone to recycle this? Or make it into, you know, energy or do something with it.
What sort of a revolution have you seen in this category over the past, I imagine, even a short period of time?
When I started out at Intel 17-odd years ago, it was people going, really, I have to recycle? Why do I want to recycle? Or some people being like me, yes, we are going to recycle, and this is how we're going to do it. And now what I find with employees is questions like, what do I do with my tea bag? There's a staple in it. How do I segregate this correctly? So I've seen over time the cultural shift in, I think it's just broad-based education, that, look, this is the right thing to do.
You referenced a culture change. Does it seem more possible for the culture shifts to happen in a high-tech industry as opposed to a more traditional, older industry?
It's a generational shift. I won't guess your age, but I remember growing up with give a hoot, don't pollute. And we see that now a couple ways, you know, you can incentivize people to do the right thing. We actually last year had, if we didn't hit the 90% solid waste recycling rate for Intel, was tied to our bonuses. So that definitely helped get people involved, right? So there's different ways of doing things. But that one, we had people involved, and I think out of the approximately, 130,000 tons of solid waste we recycled, 92% of that.
So does Intel compete internally, and does the company want to compete externally in this kind of category as well?
Internally, there was a lot of site-by-site competition. People were very passionate about, hey, you know, why is my site here? I want to be the top. Externally, I don't see this as something that this is secretive. We're going to be the best at it. We can all learn from each other, and I think we should all get better together.
Tamur Berkey is Intel's Solid Waste Program Manager.
Peoria residents will have a chance on Monday to weigh in on proposed development in the city's P83 Entertainment District at 83rd Avenue in Bell. The first phase, mainly streetscape and pedestrian improvements, is expected to start this summer. Scott White is the director of Peoria's Economic Development Services Department and says the area already has a lot going for it, including the Peoria Sports Complex, movie theaters, restaurants, and Arizona Broadway Theater, not to mention the people who live nearby.
The Bell Road corridor has a phenomenal demographic, economic demographic, in terms of household income, discretionary income levels, and households with incomes above 100,000. That's why you see the whole stretch of retail that stretches from the Loop 101 all the way eastward.
I've met White in the parking lot of the sports complex. With our backs to the ticket window, we see 17 acres of blacktop and white lines, but White sees potential.
So as if you were to just kind of visually imagine looking across this surface parking lot, to my right would be a six-story parking structure.
Now, maybe not the most exciting thing, but White says it'll be needed because the development will consume most of the existing parking spots. In fact, that garage and another smaller one represent Peoria's contributions to the project. White says the city will spend no more than $30 million on them.
And then what we have is a whole host of specialty retail.
And entertainment, a boutique hotel with a rooftop bar and restaurants to add to what's already there. The plan also envisions a pedestrian concourse to connect the area near the stadium to the existing shopping, dining, and entertainment. White says the P83 district is successful, but could be 10 times more successful.
I think that this type of new investment, public and private, in the entertainment district sends a message not only to Peoria, but the West Valley and the Valley as a whole, that we do view this as important.
How much of the city's sales tax revenue, et cetera, does this area generate now?
Right now, the entertainment district
And our auto district easily comprised probably 50% of the city's general fund.
White says part of the project will also include more branding of the P83 area. He says people sometimes think they're in Glendale since the city line isn't far away. He wants to avoid that confusion and generally any comparison to development projects around sports venues in that city.
When we first looked at this opportunity, we knew that we had to approach this a different way. And it is a different execution because we already have a successful, vibrant entertainment district with very successful anchor tenants. So we're not building new out of a cotton field. We're taking real successful area and we're looking to add it to the next level. So that's one. Two, what we're not looking to do is just add something that has a lot of community use during game day, but something that has something to offer every day. The other difference is we're not looking to build our parking structures for this project until we know that the tenants have executed leases, that the construction financing is 100% assembled, that the equity financing needed for the project is 100% assembled, and that the city has approved of the retail developer. We have approval rights on that. So we kept enough rights in the development agreement to make sure that we know what we're getting, when we're getting it, and are we getting what we want.
Will the types of shops, restaurants, other entertainment here be vastly different than what folks can get in the Westgate area?
Yeah, we've never from day one sought to compete with Westgate, nor have we sought to compete with Arrowhead Town Center. What we're looking for is really experience-based.
White says if everything goes exactly as planned, the entire project could be done by the summer of 2016, if not the following summer. You can see a rendering of what it could look like at kjzz.org.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's Michelle Hansen. I'm here with my daughter Avery, and we're at the Kiwanis Wave Pool today. Swimming season has just started. I think she's excited to be back in the pool, swimming around, moving around like a fish. So I think this is giving her that opportunity. They've got 15 minutes a wave in the wave pool, and then they open up the water slide for 15 minutes and kind of go back and forth. If the weather is good or bad, it doesn't matter. We're inside. The pool is heated, so it's nice and warm, and it seems to be a lot of fun.
Michelle Hansen at the Kiwanis Wave Pool in Tempe with her daughter Avery. If you've got ideas, hear things that make Phoenix unique, or want to show us your backstroke, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, not a museum curator? No problem. You can still vote on which art ends up in an exhibit.
We're used to rating things. I think it's part of a reaching out and hearing the voice and having an appeal. And then it becomes an event and becomes interesting.
That and more ahead. It's the show. Probably won't need your heated pool this weekend. Looks like temperatures could potentially reach triple digits. We're looking for highs of 99 or 100 degrees tomorrow and Sunday. For the rest of today, high merely of 94 degrees. It'll be clear tonight. Overnight lows in the upper 60s. It's sunny right now in Phoenix, 91 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by A24 Films, presenting Locke, starring Tom Hardy as a man with one night to make a life-changing decision with reverberating consequences. He just wants to do the right thing. Now playing in select theaters.
Some mental health advocates in Arizona say they're optimistic about care here, especially since a long-standing lawsuit on that issue has been resolved. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and even though he's hopeful about the future, Jim Dunn says there are still challenges. He's the executive director and CEO of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Arizona.
We're really kind of excited. We feel like, you know, after many years of fighting for a place at the table, we kind of are there as individuals and families that advocate for those with mental health concerns. We've got the governor and legislators and government officials and providers. They're listening to us. They're involving us in the processes, and we're excited about that. We feel like we can have better outcomes and better transform the system through this kind of a partnering.
And is that in relation to the resolution of the Arnold v. Sarn lawsuit?
That's a large part of it. You know, that's kind of caused the system to really be on their toes for like 20, 30 years. That is almost at the part of being resolved, and it's being resolved that we know there are some specific interventions that get better outcomes than others. So we're going to focus on those and hopefully help people get better and have very full and satisfying lives.
How have mental health services fared during the recent budget cuts?
Well, it was terrible for like the past couple years. You know, when they closed off the childless adult population, you know, that's our most vulnerable demographic. You could have, you know, young adults that are, you know, in the children's system, you know, full of a, you know, child and family team and full wraparound services because of their serious emotional disturbance. They turn 18, they decide they don't want to pursue other services or they don't have services available. That's that most vulnerable different demographic, you know, your 15 to 27 year old. And, you know, that was the childless adults that were kind of put out there with nothing. So, you know, with the expansion and the restoration that the governor and the legislature supported last year. And Medicaid, definitely. It hopefully will help us, you know, preclude people from getting their treatment in jails and emergency rooms.
So is it safe to say that in general, for people who need help and need treatment, it's available for them?
It is. And believe it or not, for all of Arizona's ills, we have one of the nation's best public behavioral health systems. A lot of very positive outcomes. We've been leading the way in, you know, peer support services and individuals kind of leading their lives and choosing what the recovery paths look like and involving family members and loved ones in care. So we do a lot of things very well in the public system. Unfortunately, the private sector, it doesn't often know about it.
Even though there are all these services that are available, is it still a challenge to let people who need them know that they're around and that they're available?
Definitely. And unfortunately, you know, people don't think about mental health challenges until it shows up in their family or somebody they care about. And it is, you know, 1 in 4 any given year, people will be touched by a mental health challenge.
Is there still a stigma associated with having
a
mental illness?
Sure it is, unfortunately. And you know, and it's not just the scary looking dude on the corner or the homeless man, you know, it's the doctors and lawyers and the chiefs. You'd be amazed at the people that are, you know, leading very full and satisfying and successful lives in spite of perhaps having a behavioral health or a mental health diagnosis.
Has it gotten better in that regard?
You know, for a lot it has. You know, for the people that have, you know, kind of been fighting for a seat at the table and really, you know, been wanting to have a voice, they are seeing some difference. You know, they're seeing validation. They're getting opportunities to actually, you know, help others find recovery and lead full lives. So, yeah, it's making a huge difference.
Jim Dunn is the executive director and CEO of the National Alliance on Mental Illness here in Arizona. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
Musical theater, especially the Broadway type, can cover a pretty broad spectrum, from the innocent finger-snapping of West Side Story to the edgier The Book of Mormon.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let 'em...
And the Valley's relative comfort level has been taking center stage as two coincidental theater-related happenings generated controversy. One found a group of high school students and their parents offended by a scene from Rent, performed by ASU's Lyric Opera Theater. The other had some celebrating the Book of Mormon finally coming to Gamage Auditorium, but wondering why it's taken so long. Arizona Republic arts writer and critic Kerry Lengel says Phoenix's taste for theater isn't easy to label.
The Phoenix scene is conservative compared to a place like San Francisco or Chicago in terms of what the audience is up for. But, you know, then there are a lot of other places that you might call even more conservative. And we're a big enough town that there's an audience for everything. So any kind of stereotype like that might have some basis in truth, but there's always, you know, a billion exceptions to the rule.
When you go to see a player, when you critique a player, are you thinking in terms of who's going to be reading my review, or are you thinking about this is what I saw?
When I'm writing a review, I try to balance those two things. I have to write from my own perspective, but I also have to keep in mind that I'm writing for a general audience. I don't think there's any question that it's in everyone's best interest not to surprise anybody. You know, if you go to a show at Nearly Naked Theater Company, they'll put up signs that say this show includes nudity, this show includes gunshots, this show includes strobe lights. The problem with the School of Music thing was that these were high school students. They're not adults. They are not yet legally empowered to make their own decisions. And they decided to do what was kind of a racy performance without letting anybody know that that was the case. Now, I personally don't think that that number is inappropriate for the vast majority of high school students. But I think the point there was it wasn't their decision.
When the Book of Mormon gets here and plays Gamage, is there any reason to think that people opening night but be out there with cardboard signs don't go see this kind of thing?
Is there a possibility that there will be 10 or 15 or 20 people out there? Absolutely. That's always a possibility. Is there going to be a big hullabaloo? Absolutely not. You know, one thing to note is that the Mormon Church has taken a very kind of hands-off approach on this. You know, they took out full-page ads in the New York Times saying, you've seen the musical, now read the book. And they've taken it as an opportunity to say, you know, this is all fun in some way for someone, but we are also really serious about our religion. And if people are talking about it, then we'd like to be part of the conversation. I think that's a very healthy, positive way to approach something like this.
One of the Valley's most provocative theater companies is Nearly Naked. Its artistic director is Damon Deering. When you heard about students and their parents walking out of the scene from Rent, did you understand where they were coming from, or did you just shake your head?
It makes me crazy. I shake my head. In the ASU situation, of course, I agree that the content there should have been a warning on the content just because of where we are. I don't necessarily mind content warnings, but on the other hand, I think the reaction is ridiculous. Rent is a Pulitzer Prize-winning play. It's been on Broadway. It was on Broadway for 12 years or so. I think that its content is established as fairly acceptable and fairly important, and I think mistakes were made on both ends in that area, but I think the reaction was foolish.
What about the amount of family-oriented theater we have in this community? What kind of impact do you think that has on audience reaction?
There's tons of it, and we even have Child's Play in Tempe, which is consistently ranked among the top five children's theaters in the nation. I think that also has created a sense in the Valley that theater is, by its nature, a family-friendly event. And I don't believe that that is true. I think theater, by its nature, is a provocative event that is meant to make an audience see things maybe that they don't necessarily want to admit about the human condition. That is, I think, the role of art in general.
Damon Deering, he's artistic director of Nearly Naked Theater Company.
Let's go for a walk.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood, a neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine?
There's a growing movement in neighborhoods across the U.S. where people get to know their neighborhood and each other just by walking. They're guided tours called Jane's Walks, and they're led by and for locals.
A Jane's Walk embraces the ideas of urban theorist and writer Jane Jacobs, who was born on May 4, 1916. Walks across the country will celebrate her birthday this weekend, including one in Phoenix. Jacobs' work focused on New York City and Toronto, but her ideas spread globally. A city's walkability was crucial for her. Here she is in 1962.
Suppose we actually let the sidewalks do the job that they can do best. And suppose we stop trying to provide poor substitutes for them.
She felt walkable neighborhoods were threatened by large-scale urban planning in the 50s and 60s. Jacobs protested expressways and big development, and she championed the character and charm of small neighborhoods.
Timothy Metal is a senior editor at the University of Chicago Press and co-editor of the book Reconsidering Jane Jacobs. He says Jacobs believed the best experts on any neighborhood were the people who lived there.
She really catalyzed this idea that you didn't have to be an expert and that the experts might be wrong and that your own local knowledge has much more value than people used to realize.
To stick to that mantra, Jane's Walks can be organized by anyone, anytime, with the help of the charity that started them in Toronto.
Here's how it works. Anyone who wants to be a walk leader registers on janeswalk.org. Then they get copies of materials that can be adapted to their area, plus a guide on how to organize it from start to finish. Will Novak led a Jane's Walk in Phoenix last year.
I like Phoenix history, and I like telling people about it, and a lot of times people think that Phoenix has no history, which is silly.
Novak led his walk along Adams Street in downtown Phoenix. It was half history lesson, half discussion on the future. Novak says at the time there were talks of turning the street into a pedestrian-only walkway. It sounded kind of cool.
But almost always that doesn't work out.
Novak says Jane's Walks often turn into conversations about what residents would like to see in their neighborhoods, what works, what doesn't work. And Timothy Metal says that's the point, not to make every neighborhood a Jane Jacobs neighborhood or even a Mr. Rogers neighborhood, but to make it the best neighborhood for its residents.
The idea that we can love these places and observe these places and find ways to keep them healthy or make them better is something that has, you know, universal appeal.
In Phoenix, there have also been walks around the Warehouse District in Mesa and in Sunnyslope. Novak is leading the walk tomorrow night at Central and Fillmore, and Sunday is the first Jane's Ride in Phoenix, a bike ride starting at Civic Space Park downtown. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and stories from around the country. We're getting help from reporters and producers around the region and the globe to mix the stories and news to keep you up to date and entertained.
Be ready to turn on the air conditioning in your house this weekend. Sunny skies, highs right near 100 degrees both tomorrow and Sunday. It's sunny in 91 right now.
KJZZ is supported by Goodwill of Central Arizona, turning donations from the community into programs that put people to work. You can donate today and become a job creator. Learn more at goodwillaz.org.
You can vote on pretty much anything now. Who wins the recording contract, who makes an all-star team, whose Facebook post or tweet you like best, and which pieces should be part of a museum exhibit.
We wanted to feature recent acquisitions to the herd, but we wanted to give our visitors, both those who came to the museum and those who went to our Facebook page, a chance to vote on some of the things we might include and have their involvement in the selection of artworks for the exhibit.
Diana Pardue is the curator of collections at the Heard Museum, which recently opened the exhibit called That's the Way I Like It. Pardue says the museum picked 22 of its new acquisitions and allowed people to vote on them, either in person at the museum or on the Heard's Facebook page. And she says they did, more than 1,400 votes in all, but opinions were mixed.
The winner in-house was Darren Vigil Gray. It's a landscape. It looks like a New Mexico landscape, very colorful, a little abstract, and just beautifully done.
And the online winner?
The online winner was Fausto Fernandez, and you may know Fausto's work because he did one of the tile floors at the airport, and he was a local artist. Now he lives in Los Angeles.
Pardue thinks this is the first time the Heard has done anything like this, but says it's likely she'll try it again.
I think that museums are trying to reach out to audiences in different ways, and, you know, this is one way right now. I don't really know how that will transform in the future.
Do you think that this is a way to get people more engaged, to have them vote on what's going to be in the exhibit?
We certainly hope so.
One of the things here is that in this process, the museums also get to know more about their visitors.
Richard Toon is the director of museums and museum studies at the ASU School of Human Evolution and Social Change.
So it's partly marketing, it's partly just a fun thing to do, but they gain some information too. So my guess is we'll be seeing more of this.
So what do you make of this exhibit that the Heard is doing?
It's actually a trend that seems to be happening in museums, and there are some major museums that have done this. At the moment, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts has an exhibition called Boston Loves Impressionism, and they've had people vote there from their Impressionist collection. They've got a collection of, I think, 50 or so works of art, and they've voted in 30. And that's a very successful exhibition going on now.
What's behind this?
I think that we're used to rating things. In social media, we rate everything, right? I think it's part of a reaching out and hearing the voice and having an appeal. And then it becomes an event and becomes interesting.
Is this a good trend, do you think?
It's part of a broader trend towards participation and towards not being the stuffy museum.
Does being able to participate in the creation of an exhibit make it more likely that somebody will go see it?
Well, you might want to compare your voting with somebody else's. And it's a little different because then it's not sight unseen. One of the things about museums is you pay up front for a show you're not quite sure about. Here, you've probably seen the content online, and then you can go and see it for real. So you've sort of had a bit of a preview, and your own values are involved.
Is there also sort of more of a buy-in that if you voted that I want this piece in the exhibit or I think this is the best piece, am I more likely to go see it to say, yeah, I took part in this, I voted in it, almost kind of like an election?
Yes, I think that what's really happening in museums is trying to re-engage. People are so used to now not being the passive consumers of products. They want to be involved in the process as well as enjoying what they see and experience. So it makes perfect sense. If in all other forms of life we're now participatory, this is just another way of doing that.
At the risk of sounding extraordinarily old school, do we lose something if curators don't have control? People who really know about art, have studied art, know a lot about the pieces, if they're not in control of what we're seeing in an exhibit?
Well, the chances are they're still writing the label text. They're still writing the catalog. They're still producing the elements for you to choose from. So the Boston example, they put up their work, but they collected that work. And my guess is the Herd was similar. There it was donated materials that they had accepted into their collection. And all they're doing is getting people to rate them. But the show itself will be put on by the curatorial staff.
Richard Toon is the Director of Museums and Museum Studies at the ASU School of Human Evolution and Social Change. The Herd Museum's exhibit, That's the Way I Like It, runs through the beginning of February. You can see the winners at kjzz.org.
The Valley was once home to a unique school that existed for nearly a century. Today, part of that school remains in Central Phoenix. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us how the vision for the school changed and ultimately led to its closure.
The Phoenix Indian School is part of the Steele Indian School Park. Native American children from tribes in and around Arizona attended the boarding school for nearly 100 years. Did you know the Phoenix Indian School was the only non-reservation Bureau of Indian Affairs school in Arizona?
That's right. It was unique in the fact that it was actually in the city. And at least that's how we look at it. Back in 1891, when it first opened in its location, it was actually further north, beyond the reaches of the Phoenix town site.
Kevin Waite is with the Phoenix Historic Preservation Office.
Eventually, there was a streetcar line in 1901 that connected the school to downtown Phoenix.
Phoenix Indian School opened in 1891. It was created to assimilate Native American children to white culture. Children were taken from their families. They were forced to wear military uniforms, cut their hair, and were forbidden to speak their native language. Boys were trained to become laborers, and the girls were to become domestic workers.
Over time, there were many structures that were built there. It was a very large campus for a while.
By the 1930s, the Phoenix Indian School curriculum shifted to emphasize vocational education and agricultural studies. By the 1960s, the movement to educate Native American children in tribal schools had grown. Federal officials shifted the responsibility to the tribes. In 1990, BIS closed the Phoenix Indian School.
If you look at some of the early photos and postcards from the turn of the century, there were some very grand, magnificent buildings up there, probably among the best in Phoenix in terms of architecture.
Planner Kevin Waite is referring to the three remaining buildings surrounded by waterfalls and gardens in the middle of Steele Indian School Park. The memorial and dining halls and the band building are all that remains of the Phoenix Indian School.
You know, those buildings are unique because you really don't see too many Mission Revival-style auditorium buildings. That style became more popular during the late 19th, early 20th centuries, but you didn't see it too often in schools, particularly a Native American school that was done by the federal government.
The city of Phoenix owns the structures and has restored them. One thing the city decided not to do is erase the names and initials carved by students over the years on the bricks of the buildings. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
Did you know we always want to hear from you? Send us a note to the show at kjzz.org.
And if you're about to head on the freeways, you should know there are a few accidents to avoid. 202 westbound, the Red Mountain stretch at Val Vista. There's also a collision on the 101 eastbound at I-17. That one's blocking the HOV lane.
During tonight's First Friday, you can attend a walk-in theater of sorts. The Burton Barr Central Library in downtown Phoenix will project three different pieces of art, video art, on the building's walls. It's the one-time showing of a public art project called Light It Up.
Sama El-Shabi is chair of the photography department at the University of Arizona. Her video, called Versus the Brother, will be one of the projected works. It's a video that El-Shabi says looks at gender roles and coming of age. When you watch it, you'd expect to hear something like this. Instead, it sounds like this. Silence. It's a split-screen video on one half a car doing donuts. On the other is a female aerial dancer, wrapping and unwrapping herself in black silk hanging from a ceiling. El-Shabi says the decision for silence came while editing.
I created it at first with the available sound of the car, but it dominated the dancer and made it far more aggressive and removed the fluidness of the car and its similarity to the female.
El-Shabi says she wanted to visually contrast the female dancer and male driver and show their similarities.
They're both spinning and trapped in their social constructions and their social expectations.
El-Shabi's work will join two other videos from out-of-state artists. They'll play on different walls on a 90-minute loop starting at 7:30 tonight on the Burton Barr Library. And if projected art isn't your thing, lots of other stuff to do this weekend. The 2012 Tony Award winner for Best Musical Feature, Once, is at Gamage Theater. That's until May 4th in Tempe.
If you're hungry and you like moussaka and baklava and all those sorts of things, you might want to try the Spring Greek Festival of Chandler through Sunday at the Greek Orthodox Church. Mark, I might get in trouble with my wife for not mentioning the Phoenix one, but that's many months away.
That's a little while. Public radio legend Mike Birbiglia will be taking the stage at Mesa Arts Center to share the awkward and hilarious stories that sort of make up his repertoire. That's tonight at the Mesa Arts Center.
If you want to meet another public radio legend, you might want to go to the KJZZ Travel and Discovery Expo. Mark Brody will be out there tomorrow. It is from 10
As
to
will
5.
You.
Well, yes, it'll be 10 to 5 on Saturday, 10 to 4 on Sunday. It's an event that features travel and adventure locations in Arizona and all around the world. All sorts of deals there. Again, the Travel Expo tomorrow and Sunday.
Don't let the fact that Steve and I will be there stop you from showing up either. The Cinco de Miler 5-mile and 5K run is tomorrow morning at Westgate City Center in Glendale. And runners older than 21 can enjoy some margaritas or cervezas at the finish line.
And Friday at the Wild Horse Passing Casino, that's tonight, Mark, at 8 o'clock. War, good God, y'all, what is it good for? We're playing many other hits. That's tonight at 8.
The show was produced this week by Sarah Ventry, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Alexandra Olgin, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer is our digital media editor. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our news director is Peter O'Dowd. And our executive producer is John Hoban.
And please let us know what you think. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. It's 3 o'clock.